I haven't yet found a definition that I like of old, and I don't think there is one that we would all agree on. Certainly it's not a matter of age. I meet people that are 40, 50 years old that are old, older than some people who are 70 or 80 or 90 years old. So I don't think you can define old simply by age. And what I'd like to say this morning has to do with other ways of measuring one's age and what growing older really means. And the reason I say that it'd be just as correct to simply speak on growing is that life itself is growth. And when you stop growing, you're dead. There's no getting old and then staying old and not dying. In a sense, you're dead when you stop growing. That's true of trees, it's true of flowers, it's true of anything in nature. That life is a continual growing. And there isn't too much difference in the changes that come year by year, in early life, in middle life, and those that come at the end of life. I think many of our ideas about age are false. And I'm happy that we're beginning to talk about age and find out what we really mean. When I say that life is growth, I think you'd find that certainly in the case of a child. Many of you are parents, grandparents, probably even some great-grandparents here. But is there anything more wonderful in nature and in life than the growth of the child? The infant that begins, changes every day, changes every year, and we look at it and we don't understand it, but we realize that the life is there that grows and changes. Everything changes. Feet, hands, face, every part of the body. Internally, of course, everything grows, the cells subdivide, and get this wonderful mechanism of the body, which is growing. And that continues to the very end. As someone has said, we begin to die when we're born. And in a sense, that's true, because if death consists of changes, we certainly are leaving certain situations behind one day and coming into another situation the next day. The human being is the most remarkable of all growing things. And not that we grow as tall as a tree, or as beautiful as the flowers, or as strong as the animals, but there's nothing in nature that compares with the growth of the human person. Nicholas Murray Butler, who many years was president of the Columbia University, many years ago wrote a little book in which he pointed out that there's nothing to compare with the fact that it takes 18 to 20 years for a human body to mature. Animals sometimes mature within a few weeks or years. Flowers can mature within a season. And while there are trees that grow to 100 years of age, we don't think of them in the same way as we think of a human person. 18 to 20 years to develop all of the capacities that we have, memory, thought, vision, hearing, no matter what you mention, it is a growth that takes place from the child or infant stage to the year when we say he's mature. And even that we would have difficulty agreeing on when is maturity. We used to think that 21 was the age. Well, now we're raising lowering the limit where youth can buy strong liquors to 18. We say they're mature at that age. You can use different measuring sticks, whether they're mature then or even at 21 on that point is a question. You can have your own answer. But that it takes the body over almost 20 years simply to develop the capacities that are there when the child is born is one of the marvels. Biologists today are studying the human cell, and they tell us that even from the first moment of the conception of life, that the infinitesimally small seed has within it what they call a programming, so that all of the things that later develop in the development of the body and the mind and the senses, it's all there. It's past our comprehension. We can't even see it. But we do see it in the development of the child, how the child grows outward and inward, in relationship to his environment, in relationship to other people, in relationship to himself. There is nothing else in life quite like the growth of a human being. And why should we think that that is limited to the first 20, 21 years of life? You go right on through life and these changes take place. They bring you different kinds of changes than youth has, and probably not as rapid in some cases, but certainly they are producing changes that make the mature older individual. This interest in age or old age, we think has come about quite recent. Actually, that's not true. As far back as we can go in human history, we find people wondering at the meaning of age and what it is. Some of you may have, way back in your school days, learned Latin. There was a time when Latin was part of an education. Doesn't seem to be true anymore. But one of the classics that we used to read in the Latin classes was Cicero's De Senectute. Cicero on old age. Cicero lived 2,000 years ago. He was a great Roman orator, one of the leading figures of the Roman Empire, and lived from about 100 B.C. to 40 B.C. So it's before Christ. And I find it very interesting to going back 2,000 years to see what a man like Cicero would have to say about old age. I want to read a few sentences and then come back to them in other connections. But to see how it hasn't changed very much, the way we look on life. He says it makes no sense to believe that nature would be at great pains to map out the earlier part of life, and then, like a lazy playwright, give the last act a careless once-over. You spend a lot of time on the first and second acts. Shakespeare, you know, thinks of life as five acts, and he goes on to describe what takes place in each act. Well, here's Cicero, 1,500 years before Shakespeare, thinks of life as a play, and it would be a funny situation, he says, if in this play all the emphasis were on acts 1 and 2, and the playwright didn't have much interest in what happened acts 4 and 5, whereas in a good play, even the meaning of acts 1 and 2 isn't clear until you get to the final act. Another passage, if through all his years a man has cultivated the virtues, then when he has lived a long and active life, they bring forth wonderful fruits. People who have no inner resources for living the good and happy life find every age a burden. There are young people that think life is full of boredom and burden as the people that are 50 years older than they. Use the advantages you have while you have them. When they're gone, Don't sit around wishing you could get them back. Solon, who was one of the wisest of the Greek lawgivers, who himself lived to a very old age, Cicero says, Solon, as he grew older, learned something new every day. Our forefathers held that a man was ripe for retirement at 46. Well, Cicero was way ahead of us in that respect. But he tells us that way back then, 46 was considered the time for retirement. But you'd have to remember that life wasn't so long then. And the span of years has lengthened until today, it's in the 70s. So at 46 would be a pretty ripe old age in Cicero's time. An old age that is firmly based on a foundation laid in the earlier years is the right kind of age. As for avarice in an old man, I simply can't understand it. Could anything be more ridiculous than to ask for more and more travel funds as one's journey grows closer to its end? I think a beautiful statement. Life is a trip for travel, and you're getting toward the station, and you've got to have more and more travel funds than you ever had before. You know those kind of people? I've met them. If there had never been any old men, there would never have been any civilization at all, which we can ponder, because isn't it true that the older generation has matured and kept, conserved the fruits of civilization? I like to tell younger people that if the older people didn't set up the establishment, you wouldn't have any fun in tearing it down. And therefore, the establishment itself has to be a part of life. Young people no sooner tear it down than they start building one of their own for the next generation to tear down. An actor, in order to find favor, does not have to take part all the way through a play. He need only prove himself in any act in which he may appear. A brief span of years is quite long enough for living a good and honorable life. Again, this idea of a play, Cicero says, you don't have to be in every act all through. If you have one part in the drama and you play that part, you can be a good actor. You don't have to be the main actor from beginning to end. Well, these are statements, I say, 2,000 years old about old age. So that what we talk about today is not something new at all. But we need to, I think, pick out some of these statements and dwell on them a little more carefully. When we're talking about growing, and when we say to live is to grow, and to grow is to live, you ask, how then does life develop? How does it grow? I've spent practically all my life with students, with young people, and it's a wonderful experience to see how these students enter college freshman year and go through the 4 years of college, or those of you who've been high school teachers have seen the same miracle 4 years earlier. It's very difficult, I think, for you to get any plan by which they develop. It's so different in every case. What is it that differentiates these students as they grow? Well, I've come to the conclusion, to put it into one word, and here trying to simplify things, it's a matter of interest. If a student doesn't have interest in anything, it's very hard for him to grow or to succeed. On the other hand, if he gets interested in something, you can't stop him. He'll work day and night on something that all of a sudden seems to him to become of great importance. And I'm frank to say, I don't understand how some people have these interests and others don't. It's a mystery to me, and probably to people too, why you should get this inspiration at a point of life which determines your life. And if you don't have the interest, you get into that situation where a lot of our young people are today. The tragedy, I think, of so many of the youth of today is that they don't know where they're going, or if there's any place to go, for that matter. They've lost interest in the kind of things that we have thought are important. They don't value them as we do. They're looking around for new interests which they may find or may not find. But it's a sad situation, I think, where we have so many of our own young people who haven't been able to find the interest which will determine their growth. Sometimes I blame our schools that they haven't inspired our youth with interest. And if you're keeping up with the newest experiments in elementary schools, you know how they're starting even with the youngest children, get away from certain habits or models and let the child do as he wants to help find what he's interested in. We're beginning to find that that doesn't work either. It becomes almost anarchy. The child has to be guided. And there are ways in which our school system does guide. We are putting more attention in our colleges and universities on vocational training or occupational interests. One doesn't like to admit it, but for many, many centuries, our universities have been geared to a few professions, to the lawyer, to the doctor, the public official, the preacher. And it isn't until a century or so ago that we began to feel that everybody should have a chance at a good education. Our American state universities are unique in the history of education, where we set up universities to bring the ordinary occupations of life. Many of these schools were called agricultural and technical schools, or vocational schools. And our development of farming, of the mechanic arts, is related to this great system of state universities. We're now bringing that into our junior colleges. In my state of Illinois, we have a system now of junior colleges, bringing one to probably within 50 miles of every student in the state. And 25% of the curriculum of each junior college has to be vocational. So we're paying more attention to the ordinary boy and girl, hoping that he'll be able through his education to find his work. They're not altogether successful. There are those who think that manufacturing firms, industry, and great commercial institutions should set up training programs so that young people could get into these programs. The difficulty here is that the vocations change so fast. Man spends 3-4 years getting ready for a job, and when he gets there, the job's no longer there. It's changed. The technological age is so rapid that it's hard to prepare for anything. So the merry-go-round, it's hard to get on. But we are putting more emphasis upon relating our education to the growth factor and the interest factor of youth, hoping thereby to get an interest that will get them to do the things that otherwise seem a burden. When you see how differently college youth react to the same curriculum, you realize how different people are. And yet, to set up a separate curriculum for each person would hardly be possible. But what this is doing, what Cicero said was, a happy old age depends on the foundation that you lay. And most of the problems of old age are not problems of old age at all. They're problems of youth and middle life. Unless you get the interest early in life. It's too late later to begin to change entirely. And many of us feel that our educational system should get our people interested in a variety of things. The man who has only one occupation, one vocation, one type of work, he's a tragic figure when it comes to retirement. You have to be able to develop some of the many possibilities that you have. Most people don't realize they only live probably 40% of their capacity, some not that much. We're not living to the full, and in earlier life, unless we are able to find various things that will interest us, we're like laying cement out here today, and it's all pretty soft. You can do what you want with it, but in a couple of days it'll be so hard you can't do anything. Human personality can harden when it gets to a certain period, so there's nothing you can do. It's hardened in that line. I like to think of, refer to that sign someone saw in Canada where the roads aren't too good in certain parts of the country. There was a sign where there was a crossroad. Choose your rut carefully, you'll be in it for the next 20 years, 20 miles. And you may as well choose your rut of life carefully, because you're going to be in it for many, many years. You say, I don't want it to be a rut. Well, in a sense, it shouldn't be, but you're going to be confined in it, in a sense. And if you get into it too quickly without knowing what you're getting into, you may run into a dead end. It doesn't bring you anywhere. So it's a part of our early experience to be able to find these interests that will broaden out as life goes on. Do not get boxed in on one occupation, but become aware of the many things that life has to offer. Certainly an American citizen doesn't have much excuse. With all of the opportunities that are open to us in such a mobile society as our own, where we can move from place to place, in a society where we have so many educational opportunities, there's no excuse for saying, well, there's no way in which I can get interested. If we have the notion that later life is going to depend on what we are doing now, then again, I say the problem of retirement is before you ever retire. Society doesn't know how to deal with the retirees. I've watched a good many of the programs that are being developed, or remember the time when there was no retirement idea. When there was no retirement, do you realize how recent this whole retirement business is, pension business? We take Social Security for granted now, but Social Security isn't very old. I can recall when it was considered quite an innovation when a factory got a retirement system or a pension system. We've gotten that far that we begin to make provision for old age. And I don't think there are many people now that would want to change the Social Security system whereby we take some of the income that we're making and putting it into a fund that will bring us returns later. And yet there were any number of politicians that called that socialism, wanted to have nothing to do with it. Well, if it's socialism, there must be different kinds of socialism. For Social Security has been a blessing to millions of people, and we are developing the system. It's an insurance system. It isn't a government philanthropy by any means. The funds that are set up for Social Security are figured as insurance is, so that the policy. And consequently, we're not living on government charity at all. But our economic system is built on the idea of work. If you stop to think of it, the whole American economy has grown up on there being a system of jobs. Man prepares for the job. In his middle years, he fills the job, and then he retires from the job. Business has become a part of our thinking, so that we hardly realize how it dominates every aspect of life. There are voices being raised against it today. We are beginning to realize that a nation doesn't live by business alone. And to measure a nation by its gross national product is very gross indeed. It isn't by the amount of stuff that's produced that a nation is to be judged. And yet, government itself has been confined pretty much to what is necessary for this economic system. And the first thought we have when something needs to be corrected is let the government do it. I think we'll have to begin to realize that government is limited to certain things. Life isn't limited to the government. And we should be able to develop careers that doesn't depend, that don't depend on the government. The government has to help in many ways, especially when you're dealing with the whole population. But it's a bad psychological situation when we begin to look to the government to do everything. And certainly when it comes to what I'm spending my later years in, the government can't do too much. Social Security, yes. Funding of senior citizens, yes. And senior citizens has received attention from the government in a way that's never been true before. The AARP, the American Association for Retired Persons, is a very interesting organization. Which doesn't depend on government, but on people themselves. Let's get out of the rut that life can only be what the government allows or tolerates or makes possible, but that there are aspects of life that we ourselves can determine. Society cannot give all the answers. The main responsibility rests on the individual to find avenues of service and happiness. Any one of us can, I think, point to older people who have retired and are living a happy and profitable life, useful life. Looking through the paper the other day and referred to the death of C.H. Dodd in England. It may not mean much to you, but C.H. Dodd has been a professor at Oxford and Edinburgh and Cambridge, 96 years old, I think, when he died. In the last 10, 15 years of his life, he's the one that's been back of this New English Bible translation and has lived to see it finally come out. The New Testament came out quite a while ago, the Old Testament just a few years ago. And here's a man ready to die who's able to give himself to this type of work. A little earlier, a man by the name of Lowry at Princeton, I think he was 70 years old when he began to get interested in Kierkegaard and read Danish and the new language and translate it. Well, this is from the academic world, but get down to your own community. In our community, there's a woman that I have very high regard for. She's way up in years, if you're going to count them. Yet she's busy 16, 18 hours a day managing fish in the community. Fish is this community, the enterprise where you get calls any time during the 24 hours of people who are in need, and you arrange to think someone goes to help them. And she gathers, she's got a basement full of every kind of furniture and linen and clothes, working for migrants, busy as any young person with things that has to do with other people. And here I think is where something of this earlier attitude ripens, for old age is a ripening of something that has taken a long time to mature. If you've never been interested in anybody but yourself, it's a little hard to get interested in other people when you're old. But if you have been interested in other people and their needs, and know what it means to help people in need, then the fact that you're retired and don't have the regular routine gives you an opportunity of doing what you couldn't do before. I think of a businessman who was an executive with a great agricultural implement firm, Deere and Company, who now gives all his time to working with alcoholics. He and a friend bought a house, and then they're bringing these men in for periods to try to live together and get themselves out of this habit. He's never had more fun than he has now. To be able to work helping other people is a type of activity that in older years you haven't the ability to find in the younger years. And certainly we couldn't leave this without speaking about the place that religion has in the attitude that we have towards life. It makes a world of difference whether I think of life as being lived in this world and then coming to a close, or whether I think of life as a journey through the mountains whenever you get to a high place or something higher beyond. And when I begin to close my mind to what the greater meaning of life can be, no wonder life gets boresome. And I count the days and wonder when it all ends. If life ends that way, of course it can't end too soon to some people. But to the Christian, life is greater than any one person's part in it. Again, to refer to Cicero's idea of the play, you're not the only one in the play. Your generation isn't the only one in this act. We're in a great mystery drama of the ages. And we're looking at life as something far beyond what we are able to describe. And a person that has that attitude to our life certainly finds life richer and more meaningful than the one who thinks, well, when the undertaker takes care of me and they throw the dirt on the grave, that's the end of it. Your attitude toward the end of life has a great deal to do with your attitude toward how you live. The two are parts of the same thing. And the faith that we have that life is great and meaningful and mysterious should ripen with age. Even if all through our life there have been plenty of experiences that raise our doubts. We can't understand those who don't get to an older age. Did you ever ask yourself, why should I be living when so many find life terminating at 20, 30 years younger? Is it that there may be some work, some place for you to feel that the Lord is letting you live longer? What I'm saying is that life has meaning all through the years. And if you haven't found meaning earlier, very few are going to find it when you get to down toward sunset time. The realization that life itself is mortal is something we have to face. And this has to do with how we look on life. I say if it ends here, then you would judge differently the things that you do. If you're looking far beyond, you have to face the question of death. And it's helpful for us to do it. So again, I say there's no particular reason why an older person should face death more in detail than a younger person. Because when death comes to an 18, 20, 25-year-old, it's even more of a mystery. And we think it's unnatural. The figures that are given for the number of youth killed between 18 and 25 in automobile accidents shows that death comes pretty suddenly and unexpectedly to a very large part of our youth. How to be prepared for death, no matter when it comes, is a part of life. And I repeat as a sort of a slogan that you're not ready to live until you're ready to die. There's something wrong with your philosophy of life if it doesn't include the last act of life. You're going to walk out in the fourth act and not know what the fifth is. And this idea that I can sort of avoid thinking about death, we only fool ourselves. Some people don't like to think about their own death. They don't like to think about anybody else's death. They don't face the fact that death comes to everybody and that it certainly will come to us. They don't want to prepare for their death. I meet people right along that refuse to make a will, because then they have to think about the end of life, which is absolute foolishness. You're not fooling anybody. You're not fooling yourself. And if you have something, why shouldn't you make provision for what's going to happen after you go, instead of leaving it in disorder for others to quarrel about you? Make their lives miserable. And I'm not talking about some of the thousands of dollars. I've seen children grow angry at each other because they didn't get this or that vase or some decoration in the home that mother or father wanted. We can get awfully upset over little, meaningless things. But think what happens when you have considerable wealth and you think it's going to go to some good purpose. You've spent your life accumulating it. Much of it will land in lawyers' offices. So it's just common sense to face this fact that you get to the time when you won't need this money. Cicero said he couldn't understand the old man who goes on piling up money all the time. He doesn't know why. It gets to be a habit there. I suppose that's his interest. Greed gets to be awfully hard to avoid when you get old. And why shouldn't we use what we've got and get the joy out of using it while we have it? This idea of piling up things until we're dead and then see what can happen, it doesn't cast any particular merit on the person. Let us face frankly what we have, what we want to do with it, how we can use it, the way we think that it should be used. I've seen so many examples of where what a person thought he'd spent his lifetime acquiring has not gone at all to what he expected. Someone else took it, or ended in court cases. Do make a will, but beyond that, use what you don't need. Why should you not use what you've got before you die? Oh, I know the argument. I don't know when I'm going to die, and I may need it. But some people think they're going to die, going to live 1,000 years the way they're accumulating it. Of course you can. Bankers and lawyers tell us now that one of the best ways is to make a living trust, where you have control of your money, but you can decide where the income is going to go while you live. You can change it while you're living, but it goes on afterwards the way you set it up. These are I would say, a part of a person's duty towards those one leaves behind. But the idea that they come, which is the end of life, it's not a morbid thing. I don't share the thought at all that we escape feelings by not thinking of death. There's no Greek fable that tells a man who asked the gods for an endless life, and they gave it to him. But he forgot to specify very much, and as he grew older, he grew smaller, he withered, he wizened, he finally ended up like an insect. He couldn't die, and his wish was to die. This thought that I don't want to die and I'm going to live forever, that itself is defeating. Not that you have to welcome death. I think of a old pastor friend of mine who lived to be over 80, says, I'm all prepared to go, but I'm in no hurry. And I think that's a good attitude. You don't have to be in any hurry about it, but be sure you know where you're going and what you're doing and what how things are when you do go. And it's too late if you wait too long. But that there is a finality to life, that there is such thing as death, comes to the person who faces facts as they are. We are mortal. There is a limit to our growth. We can grow as we grow older, grow in interest, grow in unselfishness, grow in helpfulness, grow in thanksgiving for what life has meant. But there is an end to this life, and we should make our plans accordingly. I'm surprised how little the New Testament talks about death in this sense. I can't think of very many places where the New Testament dwells on the idea of one dying, except what it does dwell on is that I have died to sin, that I live in Christ, that I live a life that is eternal. And thought has grown on me through the years that eternity doesn't begin the day after I die. I'm in eternity now. The past was a part of eternity. Eternal means without end, without beginning or end. God is without beginning or end. He is eternal, a thought that is beyond human comprehension. You can't understand it. No one has. But what Scripture speaks about is that the person who has found that in Christ the secret of life doesn't fear death because death has no power over him. Death doesn't separate us from God. There is the New Testament emphasis. Nothing in life, not even death, can separate us from the love of God that is in Jesus Christ. So in a sense, we are living now in eternity because of the quality of life that we have found. And life is not to be measured in quantitative terms, but in qualitative terms. And to have found what the Christian finds in the Scriptures is to have found a God who is the God of life. Jesus says, my Father worketh and he worketh hitherto. God created the world, but he creates today. Today is as much a marvel as the first day of creation. God gives me today, which is no more wonderful than the first day of life that he gave me. We're growing in the knowledge of God, if we are Christians, in the sense that this is the God who is the source of life. Jesus again said, God is the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. He's the God of the living, not of the dead. God is life. He creates life. Life is the essence of God. And life in God life in Christ is to have found him from whom all life comes. Therefore, death doesn't scare us. Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil. The day before we came out here, the last Sunday of September, of August, my wife and I visited a very close friend whom we've known many years. She's dying of cancer. And we knew that we'd never see her again. But she said, "I'm not afraid of death. When I lie down and go to sleep at night, I believe I'll wake up in the morning. When I die, I believe that sleep from which God awakened me." That, I think, is a helpful way of looking on death. Facing it, knowing what it involves as far as separation here is concerned, but knowing that it is not a separation from life, but in ways that we don't know, in ways we can't describe even. Eye hath not seen, ear hath not heard, nor has it entered into the imagination of man to know what God has prepared for those who love him. In my Father's house are many mansions. When we limit life to a few years here, we're limiting God, which shows a lack of faith and trust in him. But if we trust him and sense something of the infinite greatness of God, then we can believe that a life that he created must have more meaning than for just these few years. And so the end of it, as far as I'm concerned, is that life begins as a mystery, life continues as a mystery, life ends as a mystery. We don't grow into understanding everything. We grow into an appreciation of the mysteries of God. And as we do that, life has meaning for us, more than death, for it is a growth that is endless as far as we can say, but we can't tell how. So I come back to this, that we shouldn't emphasize age, shouldn't emphasize growing older, but simply a matter of growing. As long as we grow in knowledge, grow in trust, grow in gratitude, grow in appreciation of life, grow in obedience to Christ, grow in service to our fellow men, age doesn't make much difference. The real differences come from this knowledge of what the meaning of life is, the mystery of life. And the older one gets, the more one understands of life, the more one reads, the more one sees. One doesn't understand, but one should believe, one should trust, one should be content that there is one who understands, and that we're safe in his keeping. Well, that's my presentation. Are there any questions anyone has?
We'll start our session. Time runs along pretty fast. This is our third visit to Holden, and this full month has been a very rich one for my wife and myself. I want to express our appreciation for all the experiences that have been ours. Anyone who's been at Holden longs back again, and we have added a treasury of memories from this time. It's been a busy month in some ways. Checking over the things I've talked about this month, and a little surprised myself that I had to appear so often, but I've been glad to serve if I could. I gave about 10 or 12 lectures on China. I had a couple of sessions on the unity of the church in hymnal and liturgy. couple on One Holy Catholic Apostolic Church, on the Third World, on the Jewish problem, and tonight I'm finishing up with a few impressions from a visit to the Holy Land in Greece, which my wife and I took about a year and a half ago. I think if I were to give a title to it, I would say In the Footsteps of Jesus and of Paul. But it's not going to be a very formal, nor I hope a very long session. So I would like to share with you some of the memories that one takes after a lifelong anticipation of seeing the land of the New Testament and the Old, anticipations which include a great many imaginings of what the Holy Land must be. All of us who've read the stories of the Old and New Testament since childhood have formed certain pictures, I'm sure, of the country and of the people that the Bible talks about. My one regret after coming back from this visit is that I didn't make it 25 years ago, or even longer, for it would have enriched the background with which one reads the Old and New Testament. I'm not giving a travelogue by any means, but I'd like to tell you what are the things that impressed me most and some of the questions that remain after a trip of that kind, both for the church and for our communities. One travels to Israel today in a good deal of comfort. We flew directly from New York to Paris, and then from Paris to Tel Aviv in a Israeli plane. So we were introduced to Israel on the plane itself. The airport at Tel Aviv is as modern as any. We landed at night. This is before much of the hijacking, so that we weren't very much handicapped by having to go through a lot of inspection. But our itinerary was such that we took a taxi or a bus ride from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem by night, and came across the dark Judean hills into Jerusalem. We didn't see much that evening of the Holy Land. And the next morning when we woke up, I went outside. This was the 12th of March. I remember the date because it was my wife's birthday. And always I remember it, but this time the event helped to. And believe it or not, all of the holy city was covered with snow. We were in the hotel, the international hotel that sits on top of the Mount of Olives. And you look out westward over the valley up to the city of Jerusalem with the gold dome of the Dome of the Rock Mosque as a central point. You can't help but look at it and see other things in relationship to it. But to see Jerusalem covered with snow was certainly a surprise. I hadn't expected that, and they told us that it was a very unusual thing. It doesn't last very long. By noon it was gone, but further north the storm had been strong enough to close the roads up around Mount Hermon, and we had to change our itinerary a little bit. Jerusalem is a city that we think of as an ancient city, but the first change you have to make in your mind is that you're in a very modern city, not so much in Jerusalem as in Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv isn't too far from Jerusalem, and it has grown to be, it reminded me as much as anything of Miami Beach. A great big high hotels along the Mediterranean seacoast, luxury hotels, many of them, where the millionaires, those with less money, come from all parts of the world, especially the United States, to spend certainly the Jewish holidays. I suppose now there are thousands of them there.
But Tel Aviv is a modern city, and the buildings compare with the skyscrapers and luxury apartments of our own country. Jerusalem is both an old walled city and a new city. When we read in the Bible, we are reading about the old city within the walls mostly. But the new city of Jerusalem has spread out far beyond the walls. One can't go very far before you realize that something has happened in our own lifetime to change the appearance of Jerusalem. It isn't very long ago that the Arabs controlled it. And not so long ago either that the Jews themselves couldn't get into Jerusalem. What they most grieved over was that they couldn't get near the Wailing Wall. You've all seen pictures of the Wailing Wall. We were there on a Friday evening, and there were Jews from all over the world, different dresses, different languages, different appearances. The Wailing Wall is the base of the place where the old temple stood. It's all that remains of the temple area, but the wall where the Jews gathered for many years and where they now again gather to pray is called that because it was for the lamentation over the fate of Jerusalem. It runs a couple blocks, it's very long, and in the rocks of the foundation are niches. And it's a habit for many to write a prayer, roll it up in a paper and stick it into a crevice. So you'll have these prayer petitions in the crevices of the Wailing Wall. But there'll also be, as there were that evening, groups of men. Women weren't allowed there. A little further away, there was a place where the women were fenced in, beyond which they couldn't go. But at the Wailing Wall itself, there were only men, old and young, and they would have a liturgical service following certain orders that they had in their books or knew by heart. So you'd have all kinds of these recitation of prayers and singing of liturgical hymns going on at the same time. Different languages, no one pay much attention to another group, you're only there yourself. It is one of the sites you never forget after you've been in Jerusalem, and one of the things you go to Jerusalem for, because it is so well known. It's ironic that this is the place where the temple stood, where the temple no longer is. You go up on top of this huge platform of rock, and there stands a Mohammedan mosque. For the Muslims built one of their most beautiful mosques on top of it. You have to take your shoes off and you go inside, covered with luxurious Turkish rugs, and marble walls with mosaics in gold and silver, huge columns of beautiful stone. It is one of the central places of worship for the Mohammedans. And in one place, there's a rock, think of it when you see this rock here, because it was as large as this, not as smooth, though just smooth on top, sort of circular. This was the, according to the tradition, Mount Moriah, where Abraham was willing to sacrifice Isaac. And the stone represents this holy event which Mohammedans as well as Jews look back on in their history. It's called the Dome of the Rock because of this rock, and the dome is right over it, the gold dome, which is visible far and wide. Well, we can't stop very long at these places, but this is a central portion that every pilgrim wants to go to. It's in the old city. We came down from the Mount of Olives, on which this international hotel is situated, down through the Valley of Hinnom, which is a great big valley of cemeteries. The cemetery stones are still standing there in many places. And then you come up toward the temple, As you think of the psalms, psalms of ascent when you went up to the temple, which we have in the book of Psalms, one can easily relive yourself into the experience of the old temple, of the Old Testament, as you approach the temple. I'm not going to spend much time on other things in Jerusalem except to say that for me, one of the disappointing experiences was the Via Dolorosa. The Via Dolorosa represents the way of the cross that Jesus followed to his death. You come to a place which isn't too far from the temple area, where Pilate had his judgment seat, where the Roman soldiers quartered their horses. You start out from the judgment hall, and then you wind your way down through a narrow path between buildings on both sides, sometimes just like a little lane, past the various stations of the cross. As you know, the Roman Catholic Church has stations of the cross, representing each of the phases of the suffering of Christ. And this Via Dolorosa is supposed to do that for you here in the place where it happened. Well, I'd say disappointing because there's so much commercialism. As you walk through this, these lanes between the buildings, you'll have on both sides I think literally hundreds of small Arab shops where they sell every kind of souvenir, getting pilgrims, of course, or tourists to buy, and they have a thriving trade. But you almost lose the sense of the religious memories that you are trying to recall as you see this highly pressured salesmanship. They send out little boys or youth to try to get you into a store, and then they show you all the kinds of things that are there. But you do follow through from the judgment hall to the place where Jesus was mocked by the soldiers and where he was heard by the priests and people, until you finally come to the place where he was crucified, and finally to the Holy Sepulchre, where the tomb was. I suppose it would be a quarter of a mile, I'm not sure. You lose all sense of the distance as you thread your way through all of these crowds in this melee. But the Church of the Holy Sepulchre doesn't leave you with much of a happier impression either. Because from very early times, the various divisions of Christians have quarreled about the place. The tradition goes way back to the time of Constantine, 4th century, that this was the place where Jesus was crucified and where they removed him outside of what was then the city wall to the tomb. But the Greek Orthodox Church has a chapel there. The Roman Catholics have a chapel. The Armenians have a chapel. And there have been times when the government has to send in soldiers to keep peace between these Christians as they celebrate the rite of Easter, the resurrection of Christ. It makes you sad to think that this is the way that we remember this great event. But as long as you have this feeling, which isn't altogether religious, it's partly nationalistic, I suppose it's going to be hard to overcome. They've even built on top of one of the chapels has a roof, and another denomination built on top of that roof. So it's a question of where does the line of demarcation go. There's constant quarreling. Well, it is interesting to step into the place where, as far as you know, Jesus was buried in the deep crypt, which the Armenians have the chapel for. Roman Catholics are building a larger one. All of these are clustered in a place not much bigger than this hall. Well, that is one of the things that you can never forget, though I can't say it makes it any clearer or more impressive when you read the New Testament story, the Passion, to recall that. I hope other people have different experiences, but I can't say that it was an inspiring experience to me. Jerusalem, of course, was not the place where Jesus spent most of his ministry. So the person who's interested in the New Testament will go out in the country to where he did most of his ministry, but the great events of the end of his life are in Jerusalem. I suppose it makes a difference who you go with to the Holy Land. Our arrangements were such that we were partly on our own, but partly were with a tour through the outlying districts and the rest of the Holy Land. And we didn't know until we got on the tour that we were the two Gentiles among 40 Jews. So we got the Old Testament view of things, which I don't regret at all. I've compared my notes or memories with people who've gone on Christian trips. And my feeling is that you get more by going with people different from yourself than those who have their minds all made up and are only interested in certain places. Some of these people never get beyond Jerusalem, or probably up to Galilee. It's fine to have memories, but if you want to see Palestine as it is today, you have to go much farther than that. We spent about almost a week on that tour, and they had two Old Testament prophets as our guides. One was Jeremiah and the other was Zechariah. They spoke Hebrew or Yiddish. The 40 Jews who were on the trip were all from America, so we could speak English to them. Of course, they were interested in other things as well as the New Testament. Well, this trip that we took took us from Dan to Beersheba. I never quite understood the meaning of that until you actually made the trip. Dan is way up north, Beersheba's way down south. And we were fortunate to be able to cover most of the Holy Land. We went down to Jericho, where we saw some of the diggings that now are beginning to uncover early layers of civilization. I was surprised at the beautiful fruits and flowers around Jericho, the modern Jericho, and how close it was to the Dead Sea. I hadn't quite realized before that Jericho is so near the Dead Sea. You do change your ideas of geography after you get over there. These cities, Bethlehem is very close to Jerusalem, and Hebron, Mamre, these places, which before you get there, you don't know quite where they are. Well, our trip took us down to Bethlehem. I'm not going to follow exactly the series, but to indicate some of the places we did see. And here again, one comes away with mixed feeling. Bethlehem, we think of as a little town of Bethlehem, Australia. Well, there wasn't much of that there, because Bethlehem is one of the places where Jews and Arabs are at each other. And Arabs are in the majority. The Jews have to stay by themselves to sort of protect themselves.
And
yes, they were geographically separated. The place where you are shown the birthplace of Jesus has a big church. And this is true of practically all the places in Palestine that you would visit. Some European or other part of the church has built a great big church over it. Usually some of the Roman orders have built these churches on the place. In Bethlehem, where Jesus was born, you come into the place, you go through this church and down to the crypt where the place is shown to you. You hear a lot of things that you very soon get very skeptical about. Years ago, we were in Rome, and spent 2-3 days with a guide who took us through all these Roman antiquities and told us about the saints and the bones and the treasures that we saw. Finally, the third day, an American in the party got a little impatient. He asked the guide, "Do you really believe these things you're telling us?" And I never forget the answer that the man gave. He says, "I'm Italian, I'm a good Catholic. As a Catholic, I believe these things. As a man, I have my doubts." And that's about the attitude you get after you hear some of these stories. In Bethlehem, they showed us where the cradle stood. Well, that was okay. But they went on to tell us that the Crusaders took the cradle away. Crusaders came to the Holy Land around 1100 AD. So about 1,000 years after the birth of Christ, they took the cradle. The splinters of it are in Rome, so if you want to see the cradle, you go to Rome. Well, now you believe that, it's all right with me, but I have my doubts. So you have to choose between the things they tell you. Legends grow up around any shrine, any holy place. So that's to be expected. But it does do something to you to stand in a place where Mary and Joseph found refuge and where Jesus was born. Well, our trip took us around down to the Dead Sea, which is a forlorn-looking place. Sea it is, because it's water, but it's mostly salt, and very few people get in. I did see some American, I think, in bathing suits or something. But it didn't look very inviting at all. Up on the side were high cliffs with caves that reminded us of the place where the Qumran scrolls were found, which is a very interesting story. But the Dead Sea isn't a very attractive place as such. The one spot on it I shall never forget, that was Masada. And I don't find that too many Americans have been in Masada, because it's a Jewish place, and Christians aren't particularly aware of it, I guess. But Masada was a high place that Herod had used to build some beautiful palaces on. And then when the Romans came and destroyed Jerusalem, the last Jewish refugees found a place up there in Masada, which is a high cliff. And it's almost impossible to get at. If the ones on top want to roll stones down, they're able to keep the troops from coming up. On one side, it's very steep down to the Dead Sea itself. On the other side, there's a little more gradual approach. The Roman soldiers tried for months to starve these people out and didn't succeed. About 100 of them. And finally, the Romans had no other way than to build a ramp all the way up to the top and that way get at them. But before they got there, these Jews that were left had made a compact that no living Jew would fall into the hand of the Romans. They decided who was to plunge a sword into somebody else. Father would take care of his family, someone else did. Their relatives. And the night before the Romans came in, they all committed suicide. It's one of the terrible chapters in human history, but showed this intense loyalty of the Jews to their nation, even to the point of taking their own lives lest they be captured by the Romans. I climbed Masada.
You did better than a lot of young people that they told me.
I've done some hiking in Holden
man,
before.
He's great.
It isn't as bad as getting up to Holden Lake here. But it is quite a sight to get up there and see out over the Dead Sea and to think of the events of long ago. We swung around up along the Jordan, which is a very narrow street. If you think of the Jordan as a Mississippi or Missouri or Columbia River, you're mistaken. It's more like Railroad Creek here, as far as width is concerned. They say in some places you can jump across. I'm not sure that's true, but it isn't very wide. But what makes it so rapid is that it descends from Galilee to the Dead Sea in so great an altitude that there's it's almost like a waterfall. Of course, not that bad, but this gravity pulls it down. The Dead Sea, which is over 1,000 feet below sea level. The Jordan is not a large river, and when you're in a bus and touring alongside of it, you don't see it, though I recall up in northern Galilee, we crossed it on a bridge which couldn't have been much larger than a bridge across the railroad creek out here. So in itself, it may not be very impressive, but the history that has lived along Jordan is a very wonderful thing. There's a Jewish author, he was at the Jewish seminary in Cincinnati, name slipping just now, who's written a book on the River Jordan, where he starts in the Dead Sea and goes up and gives you the history of all the towns and events through the centuries that have been along the Jordan. Jordan's one of the most historic streams in human history. We went through Samaria and up into Galilee. And that is the part of the country that you will not be disappointed in. I think our most beautiful memories are from Galilee. The lake itself was a little larger than I thought, and very attractive. Boats out there, they fish. There's a certain fish they catch, they call it Peter's fish, from Peter's fishing. And it is a gentle, it's not the kind of the lake you have here in Washington, but a beautiful lake in a rolling part of the country. Galilee is the most attractive part of Palestine. And as you go up and down the hills around the Sea of Galilee with their plains, sheep grazing there, old villages here and there, you are back in New Testament times. You can relive the towns that you remember from the Galilean ministry. Nazareth, again, has changed a great deal and is not what you would have imagined it to be. Nazareth is a strong Arab center, and you leave the modern Nazareth to go to the older Nazareth, where again there is a great big church built by German Catholics over the place where Jesus is supposed to have worked with his father in a carpenter shop, and they have tools and things down there under the church itself to recall that history. From Nazareth, we went further north and got up into the country where you are still reading about today, the Golan Heights, where Galilee adjoined Syria. Here is where the guerrilla fights have been going on for a long time. The Golan Heights are high enough so that the Syrians were able to place their guns there and command a great part of the valley below. It was here that the Israel army made such a quick end to the Syrians in the Six-Day War, and as you drive along, the guide will stop and they'll point out the tank that's all rusted and broken up, one of the Syrian tanks that the Israeli soldiers destroyed. They're scattered far and wide here as the mementos of when Israel was able to wrest it from Syria. We turned westward and went through Tiberias, through places that you read about in the New Testament, places that Herod was associated with, and where the story brings you back into Greek times. Peculiarly enough, in one of these valleys where the Jordan starts, there's a niche in the hill with it, where it once was a statue of Pan, the Greek god. Getting back into places where Greek paganism vied with Romanism. I should have said that around Galilee, probably the most impressive city that I saw in the old part of the Holy Land was Tiberias, with beautiful buildings. It had been a place where Jews have gone through many centuries and have built up places of learning, of culture. I would like to have stayed much longer in Tiberias. But we came over to the Mediterranean coast and then down from Acre, where you have a lot of memories from the Crusades. And the Crusades are no great compliment to Christianity either. When you see what they did and what it cost both them and the Jewish people, it doesn't make you feel any proud, any more proud to have been a European because the Crusaders came from there. Well, there were Roman memories down along the sea coast. We came down to Haifa and Jaffa. Haifa is a modern seaport. Reminds you something of New York on a small scale. And it has become a great center for the commercial life of Israel. Then down further south into Jaffa, where Peter saw the vision of the sheep, and further down to the southern part of the country where you get into modern cities, Ashdod, for instance, where the Jews have built up a place to receive so many of these new immigrants. We got down as far as the Gaza Strip and then turned west and came over to Beersheba, which is right in the midst of the desert. You ride for hours and hours and see nothing but desert. You see hillsides and nothing there, but on a contour on the hill you may see a camel or two. It's sort of a desolate part of the country, and yet Beersheba is a miracle of city building. They built a new city right out of the desert. Modern apartments, hotels, everything convenient. My doctor at home happens to be Jewish. He tells me that he has some money invested in an apartment in Beersheba, which shows how close we are to Israel. I should have mentioned one other point in regard to the Jordan, which I think leaves an indelible memory. And that's where the Jordan leaves the Sea of Galilee and flows south. A very small spot, but one of the impressive spots that you'll see in Galilee. I mention it because here is one of the big issues between the Arabs and the Jews. Who's going to have the water of the Jordan? With so much desert, so little water, you'd fight for every drop, practically. And when the Jews started to divert some of the water of the Jordan, the Arabs threatened to cut off the water supply further up, so there wouldn't be any to divert and dry up the sea. They still haven't, of course, come to any solution. The Jordan rises way up there near Mount Hermon. There are two or three little places where you can see the water coming through a sort of a gully or a gorge, which is one of the springs of the Jordan. And every reference in the Psalm means more to you after you've seen the Jordan than before. Well, here we are, and I've only begun the story. I'll have to cut it short. But what I've said, I think, would indicate to you that you're in the midst of two cultures. Whether it's in Jerusalem, whether it's around the Jordan, whether it's the Gaza Strip, the issue is, do the Jews have a right to be there? Remember that until recent times, they weren't allowed to be there. That after the Muslim conquest, there were practically no Jews in Palestine. And it wasn't until the last century, 19th century, that some of the Jews persecuted up in Russia and Poland began to settle it. They'd buy land from the Arabs down in Palestine. And before 1914, there were some 75,000 Jews in Palestine, which, however, was a rather small number among a million Arabs. And they didn't create any problem. But things changed when the Zionist movement started. And the Zionist movement was a movement of Jews in other parts of the world to get a place they could call their homeland, to which persecuted Jews could come from all over the world. The name of Herzl is prominent here, man who died about 1904, I think. So from the latter part of the 19th century that this movement grew, and 10 years later, when the World War broke out, some of these plans for a dream of a home for the Jews became realized, because all of this had been under Turkey, and Turkey was conquered in the World War, along with Germany, and Britain took over the mandate for Palestine. Britain was sympathetic with the Jews, and the Lord Balfour Declaration declared that it was the intention of the British government to give the Jews a homeland in Palestine. Adding this cryptic statement without any prejudice to Arab interest. Well, it took a politician to write that. Because how could you insert hundreds of thousands of Jews into a land that wasn't theirs? But after the First World War, the movement grew, and the Jews started coming. Britain got the League of Nations to endorse it. They had a right to go there and settle in places where the Arabs weren't, or where the Arabs let them settle or couldn't stop them. The Jews came and built up a civilization that is a marvel. They'd go into the desert, and where there was sand, they would make the rose bloom. You go to the kibbutz, the plural is kibbutzim, and the kibbutz is a group of people who come together in a sort of a commune. They do things together and work up a agricultural unit or a commercial unit and live together. They have meals together. It's a very interesting experiment. And they've come from all over the world to these. I met American girls down and boys down in these kibbutzim for a year or two, like coming to Holden almost for a religious experience, because it was a way of building up Zion. Though I was surprised to find there were kibbutz that were not religious. One kibbutz said we were atheists. But the idea was still to be a part of the Jewish homeland. It wasn't until 1948 that the Jews finally got enough land and enough authority to set up Israel as a government. As a result of conditions after the Second World War, which I haven't time to detail here. But government was set up, and Israel got started, and the United Nations tried to divide the land between the Arabs and the Jews, ran the line right through Jerusalem almost, so that Jews couldn't get into the holy places of their own city. But they also gave much of Galilee to the Arabs, and the Jews were not happy. And the United Nations said, let's internationalize Jerusalem, which the Jews and the Pope were in on that, but the Jews were opposed to it. What happened after 48 and later after 67, the Six-Day War, was that the Jews, by their own armies, modern weapons, which we've supplied to them to a great extent, were able to conquer Egypt and the Arabs quite easily. And they now hold the land by force of arms. The question as to the rights of the Arabs is still unsettled. There are some 300,000 Arabs still in the occupied parts. There are 700,000 Arabs outside. They fled across the Jordan, or they fled down to the Gaza Strip. And then after the Seven-Day War, they're back in under the occupation of Israel again. So you have hundreds of thousands, sometimes you see the figure a million, Arabs who are dispossessed. And Israel says, you come back, we'll treat you as citizens like ourselves. There's a Jewish parliament now, the Knesset. There are 8 or 9 Arab members there. But the Arabs don't want to come back. For one thing, their lands aren't there. They'd have to start over again. The Jews took their lands. How to recompense them? You've seen in papers right along how this thing is being discussed, but the Jews have found no solution and the Arabs haven't either, but it remains a cause of war between them and Egypt and Syria and Lebanon. The Transjordan, has, under King Hussein, has been more friendly. But this is the situation that you are in Israel today. And the question is whether you're more interested in the modern situation with its problems or the Old Testament with the history that is so sacred to us. Well, that's only a very brief sketch. I want to say a word about the footsteps of St. Paul, because we spent a very interesting time in Greece. And here I hold myself to two cities, Athens and Corinth. How many have been to Athens here? Now, there are a few. And you've seen one of the great relics of ancient civilization, the Parthenon, which does inspire you when you come in and see on that high hillside these broken columns and the remnants of one of the most beautiful structures man has ever built, standing in ruins, and on a pile of the rock which you had to climb up this hill to get to. But once you're there, you're in the old Greek world. And the students of art could spend a long time telling what you see there. You remember that the Turks blew it up, or a shot from the Turkish cannon ignited ammunition and blew this thing apart. But it's also true that modern pollution in the air is breaking up the surface of these columns. It isn't only war. How long it'll stand, no one knows, but it is one of the great sights yet of the world. For a Christian, a little bit down from the Parthenon is an interesting place, Mars Hill, where Paul preached his famous sermon. And at this spot you'll find a bronze tablet with Paul's sermon inscribed in Greek. To stand there and read Paul's words in this place where he faced the wise men of Greece who had altars for all the gods and one to the unknown god is an inspiration. We went down to Corinth, where I had a personal reason to go. A schoolmate of mine, after he left college, we were schoolmates at Augustana, went to Berkeley, got his doctor's degree in Oriental classical research, and went back, and after 50 years is now the Dean of Archaeologists in Greece. The Archaeological Society gave him a gold medal last year for his work in Athens and Corinth. He loves Corinth so much that when he retired, he built his little home next to the marketplace of Corinth. And from his window, you see out across the Gulf of Corinth and the high mountain of Corinth, and on the other side, broken columns of the Temple of Apollo. I mention it because he's very interested in the work of St. Paul. And he took me through what his diggings have shown him about St. Paul and indicated something I'd never thought of before. He says, most people don't realize Paul spent one of the longest periods of his ministry in Corinth, 18 months, which is a long time for a man like Paul to stay in one place. And Oscar Bronnier has developed this theory. He has a couple of books on Paul's letter to the Corinthians, that Paul was so discouraged about his sermon on Mars Hill. You remember they made fun of him. He felt he didn't get anywhere in that group. Bronnier thinks Paul came down to Corinth and engaged in his profession of tent making, because here were the Isthmian Games, which drew people from all over. And Paul figured he could meet more people who came there and wanted tents while they tented out here for the games than he could in traveling around. An interesting theory, but it may throw some light on why Paul had so many connections in different parts of the Mediterranean world. Where did he meet these people? Had he met these Jews at the Isthmian Games, which were not as famous as the Olympic Games, but they drew thousands of people. And you can still see where the races were held. One of the things Bronier discovered was how the racer started. They had an ingenious little pole that you pulled with a string, and the bar fell, so they all started off at the same time, something like a horse race, I suppose. But they've dug up all of these things so they can document how these races were held. And we spent several days with him there, and to relive Paul in Corinth is one of the experiences I shall never forget. Well, here you have the New Testament, the Holy Land, the Old Testament. And once you've been there, both look a little different from what they did before. And you have ideas about the modern world. At least you can read the newspapers and understand why Ambassador Jarring has failed in reconciling Arab and Egypt. And nobody knows the answer. United Nations has tried for years. Egypt says we're going to go to war pretty soon. Israel arms and is ready, says come ahead, we'll beat you very quickly. Which they would, there's no doubt about it. Except Israel has the United States back of it and the Arabs have Russia back of it. And I find some Bible readers who look on Armageddon as taking place when these two meet down there in the Middle East. I don't feel that that's necessarily true at all. But it is true that you have here one of the hot spots of the world. And we haven't time to discuss what's the policy of the Jew, or what should it be, what's the policy of the Arab, who's had these lands all these years and done nothing about it. You see a bunch of Bedouin down there in the desert where they come in their long flowing robes to market with a few chickens and rugs, and realize how much of the land was occupied by this kind of Arab. The Jew says, we haven't taken anything away from them. We changed the land, made a living for ourselves. They're exporting fruits that they grow. Arabs never made any use of the land. That's one of the arguments. I'm not entering into it. But it shows you how complex the thing is. Well, some of us should go up to Werner. It's 9:10. Those of you who want to go to Werner, I'll stay a little longer if there are any questions. But isn't fair to him that we should keep him waiting. But he said not all come at the same time. Up to Werner, it's open house. We